up on this week's show. First impressions of ESPN's Euro 2020 coverage. How ESPN handled the Christian Eriksen emergency. Observations about Fox's Copa America broadcasts. And your feedback in the listener mailbag segment. I'm Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, joined alongside my co-host Kartik Krishnayar. Kartik, this is going to be a very fun episode. There's so much to get to. There's so much to talk about. It's sometimes hard to figure out where to start, but if you are new to the podcast, we're your weekly guide for hardcore soccer fans who want to talk about the game, but want to talk about the soccer viewing options from around the world, who want to talk about the soccer TV coverage, the streaming coverage, etc. So this is the best place to go to for that soccer media discussion, analysis, questions, and of course, a lot of your feedback in the listener mailbag segment. Now, Kartik, I think probably the best place to start off with is Euro 2020. I think both you and I have been living this now for almost a week. And with the addition of Copa America, there's games on now from 9 a.m. in the morning Eastern time all the way through till 10 p.m. Eastern time. So you got 13 hours of coverage. How are you holding up so far as the onslaught of soccer?
I'm wiped out, and I was assuming I would just, because I have a real distaste for the way this Copa America tournament is being, the way what has happened, which is the hosting of the Norte. The Norte side was the North was taken away from Colombia. The South side was taken away from Argentina, and it's now in Brazil with Bolsonaro.
Yeah, but taken away though. I mean, like Colombia.
Taken away, yeah.
Colombia said
host,
we couldn't.
Colombia couldn't host.
Right. Well, it wasn't
Colombia
taken away.
Has been screwed before with hosting tournaments. I mean, this
well,
is not nothing.
Yeah, here. but Colombia had the riots. I mean, it's not as if.
Brazil. Everything's peachy. Everything's just peachy in Brazil. Come on.
I mean,
you have governments that are responsible in Colombia and Argentina, and a government that's not responsible in Brazil. So my point is, I wasn't really keen on the tournament, but I've gotten sucked into it. So how am I managing? I don't know. I don't think I'll manage well the next couple of weeks to answer your question, but I'm still alive right now, although I'm sure like you, Chris, exhausted at the end of each day.
Yeah, I am too, but I'm picking and choosing a little bit more it's been less than a week so far, but I'm not watching every single minute of every single game. I'm skipping a couple of games here and there just to, you mean, so I don't get burnt out. But the Copa America probably, maybe I asked you the question about the Euros and Copa, but let's start off with the Copa America coverage live on Univision on the Spanish language side, and then of course on Fox Sports on the English language side. The most apparent thing I think from these broadcasts thus far on Fox is, well, and Univision too, is the empty stadiums. And I'm not sure why, but I guess I was imagining that there would be some fans in the stadiums, given how bad the COVID crisis is still in Brazil. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. But you have these huge, cavernous stadiums. You have the Maracanã. Some of these stadiums that hold, I mean, in the past have held, like, what, 120,000 people, completely empty. Yet Fox has had the fake crowd noise. And Univision too. Univision doesn't have it tuned up as much, but I'm watching these games, and even the camera angle, which is the camera that's on the pitch side, is so far back. It's a strange experience with no fans, especially at the same time that Euro 20. I mean, we saw the Hungary game against Poland and Portugal, a complete sellout. I mean, every seat filled. It's a strange experience watching these two tournaments at the same time and how different they are. And to me, to a little extent, it's taking away some of my interest in Copa America just with them being empty stadiums. What about you, Kartik? Does that influence your viewing habits at all?
Not really. It doesn't matter to me. I'm relieved that they're empty stadiums, to be honest, given the situation in Brazil.
Yeah, but what was the alternative though, right? So Colombia had the riots. Yeah. Argentina had, I mean, COVID cases still. So then Brazil gets the hosting, which, yeah, I don't agree with Brazil hosting the tournament either.
And Chile didn't want to host either, right? Chile has got a COVID issue. Maybe it could have gone there. But Brazil, I think it's wholly, you know, it's a – and there were a lot of regional governments in Brazil that didn't want to host games, state governments. There were Brazilian players who didn't want to play the tournament. So let's not pretend like Brazil – Brazil has a autocratic leader who thought this would be good for his nation's image, I guess. Let's leave it at that, which is similar to Hungary. So,
yeah, so Copa America so far in terms of the coverage itself – we're going to step aside from the politics for a minute, but the coverage itself, as far as what Fox is doing on this one, it really feels like, for me, watching these games and listening to the analysis, is that this tournament is being used as a vehicle to promote Fox's coverage of Major League Soccer and the World Cup. It feels like it's filler. Because there isn't, I mean, in terms of the pre-match studio, it's, you know, Rob Stone and Alexi Lalas and Ali Wagner. There isn't a lot of effort being put into this. And then the commentators, John Strong and Stu Holden, who are both good in their own right. But they're not experts on South American football. There's plenty of English language speaking experts that they could have used. And that's just the first couple of games. There's a lot more of the games that will be coming up where Fox will be using some of their talent, who probably know less about South American soccer. But I don't know. It just doesn't feel – I'm not excited about this Copa America, Kartik. What about you?
The coverage, well, I don't like Fox's coverage at all. I've already switched to Univision for it. This having been said, the alternative, Chris, is to have this in English on pay-per-view or on BN. So the viewers who are not happy with Fox, I understand it. I relate to it. But Fox probably got this for a song, really, rights-wise, financially, compared to some other competitions in football, soccer. And they are at least showing you the tournament. In fact, some over the air, like the Brazil-Venezuela game. You're not stuck with complaining about not having BN and saying, oh, I can't watch the Copa America because it's on BN and I'm forced to watch it on 2DNA because of that. Or people complain that there are people who seemingly don't want to watch events in Spanish, which is something I still can't get my head around. But I recognize a lot of listeners are that way, that if it's not on in English, they don't want to watch it, right? Or you get it pay-per-view. You can do what you're doing for South American qualifiers. So I my instinct, which is to hammer Fox for their coverage, I'm going to pull back on today because I think they're giving us a tournament that we would not see, would not be as accessible to us in English if not for them. Now, I have no problem watching 2DNA. As I said, I've already switched to Univision and 2DNA for this tournament. But I still think Fox is doing a good thing by making this accessible for the English language audience in this country. And if it is a platform to build for World Cup 2022 and their MLS coverage, so be it. They needed some incentive to pick up the tournament, so I guess that was what the incentive was.
I guess in a way it's probably good that they have some coverage because it before this it did seem that they were out of the game for a while, that they weren't really bidding for soccer rights. But it's not just a choice between BN Sports and pay-per-view. I mean, the last Copa America before this one, it was on ESPN Plus. Now, ESPN Plus, well, ESPN as an entity for the next 30 days has Euro 2020 as its flagship product. It's everywhere, right? It's just kind of, if you turn on ESPN and SportsCenter, chances are they're talking about Euro 2020. So it would be in competition with itself. So it probably did not, bode well for ESPN, or make sense for ESPN to actually go for the rights heavy on this one. Yeah, you're right. Fox probably got it pretty cheaply on this one. I think most people interested in Copa America watching Univision for those games. I've just been not that excited by what I've seen thus far. And maybe it'll get better, maybe it'll pick up. But most of my time has been spent watching Euro 2020.
I want to remind people of this because I think we have this conversation every 4 years or every 2 years, These major tournaments tend, the worst matches in major tournaments tend to be the first set of group stage games. always, almost universally. And the big exception was Russia 2018, where right out of the gates, you know, we had some really good matches. So be patient with both these tournaments, because especially given the circumstances of a long season, guys who were injured, you know, fitness levels maybe being lower than they would normally be in a summer tournament. They're usually not as high in the summer tournament as they are mid-season in the European seasons. I'd be patient with both these tournaments. I think the football will get better. I know Chile, Argentina was really drab. Colombia, Ecuador was really drab, just to name a few in Copa. Same thing with several of the Euro matches, but I think it's going to get better.
Yeah, I hope so too. I mean, the other factor about this too, Kartik, and that's a good point, is just last week there was World Cup qualifiers from CONMEBOL. So you had Colombia playing Argentina, Ecuador against Peru, Venezuela against Uruguay, and here a week later now they're playing Copa America. So the players haven't had much of a break, and again, playing in stadiums with no fans in there, I think that has an impact too. I'll definitely continue to watch it. It's just that so far I have not been as impressed. Now, Euro 2020 thus far, Kartik, there's a lot to go into here. But what for you have been some of your highlights of the TV coverage of the tournament thus far?
Yeah, we have to start, and I think maybe we'll have a longer discussion about this later with the way the Christian Eriksen emergency was handled, both by ESPN here on the English language side and by the BBC over in the UK, who had that specific game. BBC and ITV rotate games in the tournament, but BBC had the Denmark-Finland match, and then also Univision here on the Spanish language side. So I think that's the first thing. I think we're having a really good professional presentation. I think ESPN, I don't want to call it inconsistency, because I don't see it as inconsistency. I see it going from strength to strength, but I think you're seeing their commentators, their primary match commentators are all very different in the way they approach matches, right? And their co-commentators tend to be fairly different as well. And then in the studio, they've had a healthy rotation of people. I think Taylor Twellman has excelled with his technical and tactical knowledge, which is really showcased on the Euro Tonight show, I have to say, Chris, probably more than their normal studio shows. And I think most people aren't watching Euro Tonight. Yeah. I'm watching it.
I'm not watching it.
But I'm not sure everyone else is watching it. Are you watching it?
No, I'm not. I mean, I'm watching, you mean, three games a day. So by the time that third game's over, I mean, France, Germany on Tuesday, as we're recording this one, you mean, I'm burnt out, or I'm ready to take a break, or I'm ready to go get dinner or whatever it may be. So the Euro 2020 Tonight program, I'm not watching.
It's on pretty late. It's not on right after the games. It was one day, I think, but generally it's on 7 or 7:30, right when the games end at 5 Eastern time.
And that is a shame, because we're missing that tactical analysis. I mean, so it seems to be being basically shown almost as a leftover, kind of a little bit later in the day. We're not getting that for that 9 o'clock game or the noon game or the 3 o'clock game. It's kind of been, okay, like, hey, let's put it on at the end of the show for the Euro 2020 Tonight program, when people maybe are watching that one in more in-depth, or it's a different type of audience. Well, for the most part, I don't think I've seen any of the tactical analysis that Taylor's done.
Okay, so there was one exception to that, to the Euro Tonight thing, which was the segment he did with Chris Coleman before. Now, it was before the Denmark-Finland game, so we completely forgot about it, because obviously an hour later, all our lives were kind of changed by what happened. And so it was forgotten, but there was a really good tactical segment, although Twellman was getting into Belgium, who was not playing in the next match, right? They were playing later in the day. But of course, Belgium is a team that I think carries a lot of interest, because everybody has a favorite player who's Belgian, I think, right? It seems like so many people, when you ask them who your five favorite footballers, one of them will be one of the Belgian stars. So, and maybe the same thing for France, right? Those are the two teams in this tournament with guys who are bona fide world superstars. And Portugal also would probably be the third team there. But yeah, so they had that segment. They had a really good segment with 12 minutes analyzing Calvin Phillips' movement and Raheem Sterling's movement. And see, I've talked about Sterling's movement for years, and people who I know I have a bit of a chip on my shoulder when it comes to Raheem Sterling, because I feel like no footballer in my at least in my recent lifetime, has been as maligned as him for no reason. But the thing that managers love about Sterling, and this is why Hodgson picked him, that's why Southgate picks him, that's why Pep picked him, that's why picks him, this is why Rodgers picked him, this is why Pellegrini picked him, is that he does so much work off the ball, which you don't often see on a regular match broadcast when you're watching. So Twellman really got into Sterling's movement and why Southgate decided to start him instead of starting Grealish or maybe a quote sexier choice, and then did a similar thing with Calvin Phillips and how that double pivot for England works, and then he did a similar feature on Spain. So he's done a lot of tactical, like telestrator moving of drawing, illustrating things. Mm-hmm. But you're right, most of them are off the main coverage, which. So the main coverage ends up being a lot of filler instead of that. Would you prefer to see the tactical stuff? Because I would, but I also understand that maybe it's niche and people like me are going to watch Euro tonight anyway, and I'm the target audience for what Twellman is doing.
Right. Yeah. I would like to see that. I mean, overall, kind of big picture, overall, in terms of what I've seen from ESPN so far, honestly, I've been disappointed. And the reason being is that it's been very conservative. It's been very muted. It's been very kind of laid back. And there hasn't been a lot of debate or discussion or tactical analysis. I guess I keep on missing it. I mean, I'm watching hours and hours. It's just been a lot of talk. And I think what's missing is that you don't have a protagonist. You don't have – everyone's being too nice to one another. The way that the show is formatted is, I mean, Rhys Davies, the host, handing over to Macca. Macca gives his, 30 seconds to 45 seconds of analysis or conversation about something. Then that moves over to Del Piero, and Del Piero says this, that, and the other. Okay, back to Rhys Davies. Okay, go to the commercial. Okay, we're back in a couple of minutes. And it seems to be that kind of format throughout the day, even if the actual host is changing from Rhys Davies to Kay Murray to Kelly Cates, etc. And then when they move to the living room, when they have the living room format and they have Chris Coleman, Macca, Taylor Twellman, you know, whoever the cast of characters are, it's the same type of format. It's like, hey, Chris, what do you think about this? Okay, all right, I think this. All right, now we move on to someone. So there's all it is just kind of just one conversation after another. There isn't a lot of back and forth. Like, I disagree with you, Chris Coleman. I think that's, you mean the way that the French team set up was whatever the actual line is or the discussion point. So I think overall, this is very different than what I've been used to from ESPN in the past. ESPN in the past, I think back to World Cup 2010, World Cup 2014, Euro 2008, etc. But there was a lot of discussion. There was debate. There was like, hey, let's take Roberto Martinez and Jurgen Klinsmann and Taylor Twellman and have them on the set debating whatever the topic is and have that discussion, that back and forth. And it was really good television. What I'm getting so far is just a very casual, comfortable, nicey-nice. I mean, the studio set that they have, it reminds me of what NBC uses, where it's three people sitting at a glass desk and back and forth, and then we go to the game. I mean, it's all produced. It looks great, but I can't think of any discussion from the first week of the coverage so far where I'm like, oh my gosh, that was a great topic. That was a great debate. I'm learning something from this that I didn't know before. What about you, Kartik?
Well, I think, and you and I have talked about this privately, that they've broken out ESPN FC as like an almost completely different division. And the reality of the matter is if you watch Dan Thomas any night, he's going to push those buttons as the host. Right. So if you're watching ESPN FC, he didn't host last night. Actually, Kay Murray hosted last night, but he's been hosting prior to that during the tournament. He's going to push those buttons. So maybe they have made a concerted decision for to be very conservative and more neutral on the network side and more edgy on the plus side. I don't know, or maybe it's just a byproduct of the host. Thomas is asked the right questions. He's provocative. He's you know, he starts, he gets the commentators or the other studio pundits to mix it up with one another. Maybe that's what's lacking, because you're right. We haven't had that. We did have that in one show, which was a Euro Tonight show with Taylor Twellman on the tactical side, kind of challenging. I can't remember who it was. Chris Coleman, maybe, or Tim Howard, challenging them a bit. But yeah, on the actual mainline studio program, if we break out Euro Tonight as kind of an extraneous show that's not part of the block of coverage from 9 a.m. or 8:30 a.m. to 5. Yeah, there hasn't been much of that. And I think, in fact, I have to say the bridges between the matches have not been very interesting. I agree with you on that. The 11 to 12 bridge Eastern time, the 2 to 3 bridge have not been terribly interesting. And that's unfortunate. I think maybe we need some Jules Lorenz. We need some Gab. Marcotti. We need some of the guys that make ESPN FC such a lively show. I mean, I noticed the other day Craig Burley was talking about Scotland winning at Wembley, and he said Don Hutchison goal. I would have liked for him to have been able to say our colleague Don Hutchison goal, and you'll see Don later today on our coverage, because Don Hutchison, another guy like Burley who mixes it up, provokes some of that discussion. And Hutchison is only on ESPN Plus right now. He's not on ESPN, so that's another one.
Yeah, you're right. I think the hosts, the byproducts of the hosts are that they're being too nice. That Rhys Davies is kind of setting it up. Kelly Cates is extremely nice. And Kay Murray's, you mean, so there are very similar pieces, people in those roles. And what we're missing are the debates.
Although Seb is different, Seb Salazar. And I will say, I think he may have pushed some buttons as the host, but then he ended up being the host the day that the Ericsson thing happened. So it may have been he may not have had the opportunity. So let's wait on him maybe to see what he comes back with the next time he hosts.
So the question I have, Kartik, is the one person who can stir up that debate, who can actually be the one that everyone loves to hate or everyone loves, is Taylor Twellman. Although Taylor Twellman is doing mostly commentating, I mean, doing the big games, doing the co-commentating, I think doing a good job, especially when games are good. When it's a France against Germany and it's a fast-paced game and there's so much to see and talk about and the tactical analysis, fantastic. On those games where it's Sweden against Spain and it's slow, it's tiki-taka, but it's a different pace, and it's very rough and tumble from Sweden. And I think he has difficulty sometimes being as good in those types of games where sometimes he's a little bit over the top. John Champion, too, kind of like really talking about how wonderful this game is, how fascinating, I think, the words that John mentioned in the first half. I did not find that game fascinating at all.
Which one, the Sweden game?
Yeah, the Sweden-Spain game.
Yeah. I thought you meant the France-Germany.
No.
It wasn't fascinating at all.
No, France-Germany was very fascinating. To me, compelling, probably the best game of the tournament so far. But the Spain-Sweden game, I think John Champion and Taylor Twellman oversold it. And even during the broadcast, I mean, Twellman a few times in the first half saying, like, this is incredible. Just look what's happening before our eyes. And yes, it was interesting because it was, you mean, a Spain team misfiring against a Sweden team that was hanging on and two completely different contrasting styles of play. But overall, I think Twellman is a good co-commentator, probably one of the best in the country. But I think he's better off actually being in the studio, having those debates and being the key person to. But the way that the set is structured, I don't see that happening. It's almost like they need to change the desk and have it kind of traditionally like what they've had in the past, where they have, you mean, these people a lot closer together rather than so spread out. I just don't think that the actual way that the set's set up is and the way that the hosts are talking and the way that the show is very formulaic, and it, to me, it's not making good television.
The formulaic thing again, this is something I'd love ESPN to talk to us about. Dan Thomas and the ESPN FC show is not that formulaic. It's very good, and Thomas pushes buttons. That's the way he hosts, and I love it. I mean, I watch that show every night. I think everybody knows I'm kind of a groupie of that program. But to me, even with now, I've made this commentary before, Chris, about about NBC's coverage of the Premier League. You're right. I said nice things about ESPN at the beginning of this podcast. I still do because of the production, et cetera. And in my mind, ESPN FC is part of ESPN. But I am still doing the same thing. I will wait to see when Dan Thomas and the gang is on tonight on ESPN Plus or on Hulu and watch it. Because I need that bit of analysis because I have not gotten, and that bit of conversation and provocative and things that make me think also about the games that I just watched that I'm not getting from their mainline studio coverage. So I give you the point. You win the round on me on yeah. that, because I'm realizing I'm doing the same thing. I'm watching Euro tonight because Taylor's on every night and he's giving the tactical analysis that we're not getting during the regular studio programming. And then I'm watching ESPN FC as I always do, because those buttons will be pushed by whether it's Thomas, even when Kay hosts, and you're getting she pushes buttons on that show that she's not pushing on the on the main studio program, because I think you're right. It's very formulaic.
But
I think that's smart.
But even though that, Kartik, though, that you have Craig Burley, who's borrowed from the ESPN FC crew on the main ESPN channel for the Scotland game as one example, and we're not getting the best out of him. You mean in terms of just the format that the show is in currently, and I don't see ESPN changing the format of the show kind of midstream. They could if they wanted to. But you're right, though, too, that ESPN FC crew, as far as being more spontaneous and more lively, that's definitely the destination for that. The other thing
we were actually with one another last point when we got the list of people who were working the tournament for ESPN from ESPN PR, and I said to you I was disappointed Dan Thomas wasn't hosting, and now a couple of weeks later I'm actually relieved he's not hosting, because then I still have him on the show where he's going to push the buttons and not kind of fit into this box. So I think overall you're right, formulaic would be the word.
I would say though, Kartik, that the commentary has been great. So you look at Derek Ray and Efanikoku, fantastic. Derek Ray, probably one of the best in the world at what he does. Yep. I mean, a really scholar of the game, perfectionist, and a great conversationalist. And Efanikoku, a great pairing between the two of them. I mean, Efan is, in terms of his playing career, but very eloquent. Somebody who's probably flies under the radar when we talk about some of the best co-commentators in the game. You and I have been big fans of him for probably more than a decade in terms of
15 years for me. I mean, I've watched him in 2006, 2007 on Premier League broadcasts.
And then Mark Donaldson and Matteo Bonetti doing a great job, I think, for the games that they've done. John Champion, we've mentioned, Taylor Twellman. Steve Cangelosi, to me, has the stereotypical American accent, stereotypical American style of commentary. I've been okay with him. I'm sure that I know there's been a ton of people that haven't. And Alejandro Moreno, over the years, I've grown to respect him and like him a lot better. He is very entertaining. He's not everyone's cup of tea, though.
Okay, so actually, I'm glad you mentioned him. He's the guy who could stir it up if he's in the studio more. The stuff he was saying about Morata yesterday, which, by the way, he says on ESPN FC all the time, he's not like Morata for years. He's been right. I think I borrowed some of Ali Moreno's sayings about Morata and put him on Twitter and passed them off as my own opinion. But they're my opinion also. But that's the sort of stuff we haven't seen in the studio when he's basically like, I can't remember, was Kay Murray or Kelly Cates was saying, well, they have a Morata as their number nine. Fernando Torres isn't walking through the door. That's the kind of thing we need more of, right?
Yeah.
That was actually a good moment, and then he repeated it after the match. But we're not – because he's – so I think both Ali Moreno, Taylor Twellman, because they're being used as co-commentators, they're the two guys who can mix it up, and we're not seeing them in the studio. But then again – you mentioned Craig Burley, who is the best, I think, in the business at it, at mixing it up, provoking opinions, giving unfiltered views, and the formulaic formula of the studio shows maybe don't permit him to do that.
I would also say that actually the Macca has been underutilized. I mean, he's been used a lot, but we're not getting much out of him. I think he is much better as a co-commentator. Obviously, paired with Ian Dark is kind of the dream team on the ESPN side. But I don't know. There's not much coming out of him that I'm like, okay, wow, that was a great comment. Same thing with Chris Coleman. I mean, I'm a huge Chris Coleman fan in terms of the player and the manager. But I don't know if it's the host asking the questions or if it's him thinking that the audience doesn't know much. But it's very mediocre analysis. And I'm a huge fan of his. And I was really excited to have him on the set. But I think those are two key people that underutilized. Del Piero, I think, has a lot of knowledge, but at times his English, it's tough. He's trying to get the words out, and he's having a difficult time at times trying to, you mean, just really kind of communicate, really. Overall, I'm happy that ESPN's doing all of this coverage. What I would like to see, actually, is that rather than 30 minutes before game time, especially for that first game of the day where it's 8:30 and the broadcast starts. I mean, I would have liked to have seen ESPN start up broadcast a little bit earlier, maybe an hour pregame.
Yeah.
But overall, you have to look at this and think, okay, well, how does this compare to CBS Sports and what CBS Sports has been doing the last, say, 6 months? And it's not in the same category.
No, on the surface it's not, but CBS has never had to cover a tournament and go like this and go a summer tournament and go end to end. So we really don't know. I mean, I think the thing we compare it to is Telemundo and Univision and Fox. But I do agree with you. I think that there's they need to be a little more edgy. And as we were having the conversation, I realized, well, yeah, you know, I'm saying ESPN's doing great partly because I'm watching Euro Tonight and I'm watching ESPN FC, and I'm just kind of grouping that into ESPN's coverage of the tournament, when in fact those are outside the blocks of programming that they're showing. And then the commentary has been great. So
I would say,
obviously.
I would say, I'm sorry, just to chime in for a second, I'm so disappointed with a lot of soccer fans out there, Kartik, because the amount of people that seem to get this whole thing wrong about ESPN Plus, that they thought that Euro 2020 coverage would be live on ESPN Plus every single game, you mean the full match experience. And I guess a lot of people didn't do their homework, because we've been talking about this on the podcast for several weeks, if not months, talking about ESPN's coverage and what to expect. And you mean it's going to be on ESPN and ESPN2, and you mean it's going to be on ESPN3. It's not going to be on ESPN Plus. You'll get your multicam there. But there's been so many people complaining about this. And this is a television property. This is a major tournament. This is not a streaming destination for this tournament. So the amount of people that were holding off on getting a cable subscription or whatever to get ESPN, they were thinking that they could experience this tournament through ESPN Plus. And unfortunately, a lot of them were really upset about it, but upset at ESPN.
Yeah.
And I don't understand where the confusion was.
In fact, I think that they should be thankful ESPN is giving the enhanced features on ESPN Plus, which, by the way, I had wanted to mention that at some point during the podcast. So this is a good segue. Those are actually really good. So what I've done is I keep watching the matches on my television, but I've got my iPad open like I did during this recently completed France-Germany game after we're recording right after that match. So I could watch the player cams, and there are three different cams they have on that. I've done it for a few other matches as well. So you're still getting some tournament coverage. You're not getting any of the studio shows. You're not getting any of the wrap-up shows, because this is a television property, and every major tournament is a television property. You're not going to be able to cut the cord and watch and not have a cable subscription or access to cable. Even you can have cable through like a Fubo or a Sling, obviously, and watch the World Cup in 2 years. You're not going to be able to do that for any major tournament. I don't think until at least 2026. I mean, there might be there will be streaming components and enhanced features, I think, for all these tournaments. And that's what this is, right? This is an enhanced features. But I do not think, for those out there who thought you could watch this directly after you cut the cord and you just have streaming services, I just don't think that's going to happen for at least another 4 or 5 years.
So I'm enjoying this tournament, Kartik. I really appreciate that ESPN's putting a lot of effort in terms of having all this television coverage and wall-to-wall ESPN coverage and everything they're doing, and also the ESPN FC and then the nightly show and ESPN Plus having the multicam feature. But what we're talking about is basically what ESPN could and should be doing better, because they have an opportunity here. We've seen them have some of the most, probably some of the best televised soccer tournaments we've ever seen in this country. So we look back to, I'd say the high point really was World Cup 2014 in Brazil. That was, from start to finish, just extraordinary in terms of what they did and different things that they tried that were very experimental at the time, very risky in terms of, you mean, the kind of the setting and having the casual patio where they would have some really intelligent conversations and discussions. So they can do better. But what I would say is, Kartik, I can't believe that on the opening ceremony of Euro 2020, Andrea Bocelli, the Nessun Dorma, one of the anthems of soccer, one of the anthems of European soccer, the anthems of Italian soccer, something that has been around this game since World Cup 1990, something that is so special, something that Bocelli sang opera, this song for the Leicester game, which was just, I mean, I was in tears. And ESPN didn't even show it. I'm like, what the heck? Like, so sometimes it makes me think, sometimes it makes me wonder, does ESPN really understand and get soccer? The people that are producing these types of broadcasts. We've said the same thing about NBC. Sometimes some of those things that you, as a soccer fan, know intimately about the history of soccer, about, you mean, everything before the Premier League, you mean top flight football, first division, division one, etc. And then something like this with Bocelli, with Nessun Dorma, and they don't even show it at all. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how could they have missed this? And then this was such a eloquent moment. If you haven't seen it, go back and watch it. It's on YouTube. It's on Twitter. I watched it probably on that day, probably. I replayed it probably about 10 or 15 times. I had my family sit down and watch it. I talked to them about the history, the opera. I was in tears, absolutely in tears watching this. Tears of joy, because this was such an eloquent moment after an extremely difficult 14 months with the pandemic. And here we have Bocelli in a stadium, Olympic Stadium in Rome. And what a beautiful scene it was. What a beautiful setting it was. And ESPN completely missed the ball on this one. And I was like, I cannot believe that they did this. I was just like dumbfounded.
Shocking. Stunning. Because they wanted to set up the tournament, right? They wanted to spend an extra 15 minutes with Rhys Davies and whoever was,
I think it was
flanking him that day. I can't remember.
Well, it was Macca. It was just talking. It was Macca.
Yeah, they just
Coleman
wanted to talk more, right? And about storylines that had already been established. Now, again, this might go back to ESPN having a half an hour throwaway preview show before a U.S. game on Wednesday night, Wednesday before the Friday of kicking off the tournament. Maybe they could have had Rhys Davies, who didn't even host that show, by the way. It was Kelly Cates. Could have had Rhys Davies with the same studio people asking those questions at that time, made that an hour, and then done a proper opening ceremony. I've never seen a tournament. This is a great point, Chris. It's a few days. We've had Christian Eriksen in between, so I forgot about this. We've never had a tournament or an Olympics or, you know, some sort of international event covered by a U.S. network where they didn't show the opening ceremony, right? That's I think it's the first time that I can remember.
Yeah,
my lifetime.
We had the U2 song with Bono.
Yeah, we had Bono eventually, but that was like 10 minutes after.
So what about Tim Howard? How's he doing so far? Because that was a question that I had going into this. I wanted to go in with an open mind to give him a chance. I haven't been a big fan of his at Turner or at NBC, and I don't think he was hitting the ground running by any means. But what's your take so far on how he's doing with ESPN?
Much better. I think his camera presence has improved. I don't know if that's some production aspect of ESPN versus NBC and Turner. We know Turner had they were trying to do a thing, right? They had their shtick that they were trying to do. So maybe he just didn't fit into that. There's actually, to be honest, we're getting probably more analysis from Howard consistently than anyone in their studio, right? Who's not Twellman when he swaps in, and Moreno, right? Those two, as we said, are co-commentators also. I also want to see more of Casey Keller, actually. Casey Keller, very good analysis. Again, for those who don't know, Casey's been my favorite so far
this tournament. As far as studio analysis, really, really good. Like a professor.
Really good. Casey Keller is a co-commentator on the Bundesliga World Feed, one of the few Americans that is on any sort of World Feed for a European league. So he has a specialist expertise in the Bundesliga, and there are a lot of Bundesliga players in this tournament. So Patrick Schick scoring that goal was perfect for Keller being in studio, because he was able to go through the career trajectory of Schick the way that I don't think anyone else is able to. So that's great, but why are we seeing him just randomly? Maybe they've employed too many people. This might be part of it also, because we're saying Howard is good, and we like Howard, or I'm saying Howard is good. He's different than he's been at NBC, but I'm not seeing enough of him either, honestly. I mean, maybe they're trying to mix and match too many people in. Perhaps it's because it's a long tournament, and everybody's getting their reps now. When we get down to the knockout stages, we're going to have a more consistent lineup. Maybe there'll be cuts made. I don't know. But it seems like they're trying to do too much at times.
Yeah, there is too much, because you've got Christian Fuchs, who was a late addition. I don't think that was part of the plans. That was not in the press releases.
No, he just retired as a player in the last couple of weeks, actually.
Right. So that was good. He was good, especially given the perspective on Austria. Tim Howard, I haven't seen that much of. I mean, when he has been on, he's been better than what I've seen him do at NBC. But yeah, you're right, Kartik. I think they do have too many people, and it seems to be kind of just everyone's on rotation, and I don't know. It's disappointing, because I know they can do better. We have a comment from one of our listeners here. This is from Nick. Nick says, I understand if you don't want to discuss this on the podcast, as it is a delicate topic that is still very raw. However, if you're willing, I would love to hear your thoughts on how ESPN and UEFA handled the Christian Eriksen incident from a broadcasting perspective. I thought Derek Ray did a tremendously classy job, but the UEFA-produced feed was terrible in continuing to show the medics working on Eriksen and even showing distraught family members. Once it became clear how serious and perilous the situation was, the producers of the UEFA feed should have switched to crowd shots or zoomed out stadium shots. Once ESPN producers recognized that the UEFA feed was not doing that, they should have cut back to the studio ASAP. I specifically wanted to ask you about what kind of preparation goes into dealing with extraordinary events, and what kind of industry standards they may be in how to deal with something like this. Is there a reason ESPN didn't cut back to the studio sooner and continue to use the UEFA feed? Perhaps they needed time to get everyone in place. As rare as these kinds of disturbing events may be, broadcasters and producers have a responsibility to be prepared to deal with them properly and respect the dignity of those involved. Of course, this is on the bottom of the list of concerns related to this event, but when the dust settles, I think broadcasters need to do a serious review of how to handle extremely distressing events like this in the future. And Nick, that was really, really good feedback and some good discussion points there. Kartik, when this happened, as it was happening, where were you, and what were you thinking when this whole episode happened?
Yeah, so not only was I watching the game, I was focusing on Christian Eriksen and had been focusing on him from about the 10th minute. I don't know. Those of you who follow me on Twitter might have realized, I don't even think I posted my tournament bracket, but I actually had Denmark going to the semifinals. I had them as a sleeper, said Eriksen and Højbjerg were the big reasons why, I thought, and among like Josef Folsen and a couple of other players I really like on that team, but really Christian Eriksen. So I was focused on him. So I saw it instantaneously, and I have to, it was horrible. I have to say, I've done, you know, I kind of beat myself up about this later in the day, saying, look, this happens on football pitches every now and then. And we see people collapse. We know of people who've died on football pitches. I work in the game, so I know of even more incidents than maybe the general public. I was, I was devastated. I mean, I was crying. I was I couldn't function. And again, part of the thing that I was beating myself up about, Chris, is this is a player that I really liked. It's a player I've watched tons of between his time in the Eredivisie and then in the Premier League and now at Inter, and being a guy that really improved his game as the year went on, as Inter caught ahead of steam in this season. And so because it was a player I like so much and I follow closely, I felt like I was more devastated, and I was it was like a family member, and it was awful. It was awful to watch the camera angles. I don't know why. I don't know how they train camera people in Europe. I have to say that, but they made those mistakes that Nick mentions, and Nick is right. Nick's comments were perfect. Here's the thing, Chris. There's the same conversation going on in the UK. I've listened to some of the UK reaction, and it's to a T exactly what we're saying here. They're saying about the BBC there, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? Why didn't they cut the UEFA fee? Same things we're saying about ESPN. So I think there has to be some training, as Nick indicates, maybe in the future for an event like this, for producers to switch to another feed, for commentators. And as it turns out, our commentators did a wonderful job, Derek Ray and Efan Okoku. Okoku even saying several times, we don't need to see this. Don't show those images, right? Mm-hmm. And very openly during the broadcast. And there needs to be some sort of protocols put in place. And as far as UEFA is concerned, I don't know what they're doing, right? I don't know how no one had the sense to midstream in the event get a hold of the producer of the world feed of the UEFA controlled stadium world feed. Remember, also because of COVID, the options in terms of production are limited. That's important to remember. So ESPN, Univision, of BBC, ITV, they can't take their own cameras there, right? They're
using the same world feed.
They're all using the same feed. How this could have been so badly botched is beyond me, but the bottom line is the same conversations are happening in the UK as in the US. Now, the one caveat I would have to say, Chris, is I was so bothered by it as you were. This is all a player we know and we followed. It wasn't, again, I feel kind of – I beat myself up about it because it wasn't some random guy. I think we'd all feel bad about any random guy, but I felt especially bad because it was Christian Eriksen. That was the same case with the BBC studio and maybe a lot of the people on ESPN because they played with him or they played against him. Right. Everybody knows him. He's a star in European football. He's a big name. So maybe the BBC studio team, which was Gary Lineker and then a bunch of former players, Micah Richards and Alex Scott, et cetera, maybe they didn't have the composure yet when it happened to go back to the studio. Might have been the same thing here. Might have been very difficult to go back to the studio, and you have guys like Christian Fuchs who play with Kasper Schmeichel. He's played with Kasper Schmeichel for the last seven seasons. Mm-hmm. Maybe they weren't ready to go on air in the midst of this situation. So we have to account for that also. But then maybe you show still images of something else. Maybe you – I don't know.
Well,
how it went was bad from the imagery perspective.
Yeah. So real quickly, I mean, from my perspective, so I was sitting down watching this game live with my daughter, who's 14 years old, and I didn't see him collapse. And then I saw the TV footage go in and the players circling around him. And then all of a sudden, I mean, we're watching this live, right? Everyone's watching this live and seeing the body shake. The whole body stiff as a board, shaking, and I'm like, oh, gosh. So I said to my daughter, okay, look away. This was really disturbing to watch. And then broke out in tears, and then my in-laws were in town, so there was probably like six or seven of us circling around the television going like, oh, my gosh, what's happening here? Like, is he okay? Is he going to make it? I can't believe what's happening. And it's one of those things that's difficult. It's live sport. No, it's really difficult to prepare people for these types of instances because it's so fluky, so freaky. It hardly ever happens, right? Once in maybe, say, 5,000 games that a television producer is going to be doing is this is what's happening. But I guess it would be the UEFA producer, the person that's managing the feed, selecting which cameras to go to camera one, go to camera two, whatever it may be. I didn't have as much of an issue about that. I mean, I think the viewers around the world, I think all of us were like, hey, is he okay? What's happening? And seeing the Danish players circling around Christian and then walking him off the pitch and leading him out and seeing the fans. And actually, the fans gave me an idea of how serious this was, too, because we couldn't really see much. And I was like, okay, is he okay? And then seeing the fans crying in tears, I was like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. And after probably, so it went back to the studio. We actually went to a commercial break, came back to the studio, and it was just dead silence. I mean, Seb Salazar, Craig Burley, Christian Fuchs, I think it was, and there was silence on the set for about 2 or 3 seconds, and then Seb said, hey, this is horrible what we're seeing happening too. In hindsight, it's easy to make suggestions. I think in many ways it would have been better to go return to regular programming or to go ahead and say, okay, we're going to do a replay of yesterday's game, the Italy game, the opener, and we'll keep people updated on the ticker at the bottom of the screen as far as any updates. But the most difficult thing, I think, was ESPN continuing the broadcast, because, I mean, what can anyone say? I mean, everyone said pretty much the same things, like, oh my gosh, this is absolutely devastating, this is horrible. And I think, you mean, just talking through it, and it made it worse. It made it more depressing. And I just had to switch off the television. I switched the television and I said to my family, okay, let's get out. Let's go away. Let's just get it out of the house. And I was shocked to find out when you called me, Kartik, when you were saying, I think about an hour or two later, saying, like, hey, the game's back on. He's okay. I'm like, oh my gosh. I thought for sure that this game would have been, you mean, postponed until the following day. But going back to Nick's point in terms of the preparation that goes into dealing with events like this, I don't know, to be honest with you, because I'm not on the production side. I don't have a lot of knowledge on that side. What Kartik and I kind of share is, yes, we have some insight in terms of the industry, but we're viewing it just as fans, just like you are. And we haven't gone through training of what it's like to be a TV producer, and all the work that's required, and from that side of the business. But what I can say is that I thought that Derek Ray, fantastic in terms of the way that he talked us through that, and also Effin Okoku. I thought the two of them were just out of this world. Very informative, very, very respectful, and did an A-plus job of dealing with a situation that, you mean, it's got to be really difficult to go through. What do you say? And I think in hindsight, ESPN could have made some changes and done things differently, but I just hope to not have to see that again, because it was just such a horrible, you mean, image that's going to be in my brain for the rest of my life. I'll never forget that.
Yeah, I think that's the case with me and with many other people also. So one thing that I'm going to take ESPN and everybody else to task on is that obviously immediately after I called you and said the games are back on, I was shocked. I wasn't for the games being back on, but they were. We knew that Lukaku was playing. He plays currently with Eriksen, is very close with him. Alderweireld was for Tongan. Two former Spurs teammates of Eriksen were playing for Belgium. That was mentioned. And that was acknowledged in the broadcast and in the telecast. And obviously, Lukaku made it clear. He scores a goal, 9 minutes in, runs right to the camera and says to Christian, we love you. We love you. Stay strong. But the next day, Harry Kane is playing. They were playing. Brozovic is playing for Croatia. Yeah. Perisic is playing for Croatia. There are all these guys who are teammates or have been teammates with Eriksen. Kane in particular is close with Eriksen. In fact, Kane's spouse is close with Eriksen's spouse, Eriksen's partner, who we saw sobbing, right, inappropriately was filmed. There is no mention of Kane. All I'm hearing on both the UK coverage and the US coverage is how poorly Kane played. no coverage, no consideration for the fact that he was playing the morning after or the afternoon after one of his best mates almost dropped dead. So I have to take everybody to task on that. I think we're not – I know we all want to kind of psychologically move on. I do too, because I'm still traumatized by it. And as you said, we're going to see that image of his face and of his body in that those minutes that he was on the ground for the rest of our lives, and it's going to horrify us. But it's been too easy for commentators to move on and not actually analyze what the Eriksson situation means to some of the players who are closest to him who are still in this tournament, not just the Danish players. Okay, I know that they'll talk about that, but the players who played with him at both Inter and at Spurs, and Daley Blind, that's another one who played with him in the Netherlands before he went to Spurs, who said he was in no condition to play and got subbed off by Frank de Boer because of where his head was, quite honestly. And we now know that in hindsight. So that sort of stuff, I think, needs to be talked about, and it's not being talked about.
Yeah. The difficult thing, though, I guess we're talking about it. The difficult thing is, even for us, the TV viewer, who may not be an England fan or a Danish fan, or I mean, could be a fan of any country. It doesn't really matter. But part of the healing process for us, I think, in many ways, is to move on. So even though it is, and actually this is a good point. I mean, if you hadn't have mentioned that, Kartik, I probably wouldn't have thought about that as far as the effect that they would have had the day after on a Harry Kane is just one example of many different players that would have been affected by this. And sometimes the day after can be a lot worse than the day of. Thankfully, Christian Eriksen is back on the road to recovery. But as for soccer fans or just for humans in general, I think we all wanted to move on. We all wanted Sunday to be a positive day and to be focused on goal scoring and the tournament progressing just in our own healing process, our own way to deal with the kind of just the tragedy, just the horror really of what happened on Saturday. So it's probably kind of a fault of human nature in some ways is that we want to move on. Speaking of moving on, Kartik, we will move on. All right, not a lot of TV streaming news this week, but something that a colleague, well, not a colleague, but actually a former colleague of yours, Bob Williams from Sport Business, publication, an industry publication, wrote a really great piece about ESPN Plus and La Liga and relevant sports and how the deal was signed, etc. But there was one interesting thing in particular that came out of that article, and I'll have you read it to let us know.
Yeah. So ESPN Plus, this is actually, now that I think about it, not surprising, now that Bob's written about it, is lagging well behind on its targets for Hispanic subscriptions. And La Liga will offer something strategic for that audience that they can't get otherwise. So that to me was a big deal. And then the other piece was that ESPN is doubtful that they're a real player in acquiring Premier League rights next season after losing the Serie A rights to CBS Sports. What we know is that the Serie A rights for CBS Sports basically went for about the same dollar amount per year, maybe even slightly less than the combined FA Cup Serie A package IMG had sold to ESPN 3 years earlier, and ESPN decided not to pay that, and CBS decided that they could afford to pay that. So, when looking at that, you think Premier League and looking at what they've shelled out on La Liga, Premier League, very unlikely, and that's basically been confirmed by this story.
Well, yeah, and part of it is conjecture on Sport Business's side and Bob Williams, but the other key piece of this, Kartik, too, is that it said Sport Business understands that La Liga for ESPN, it acts as something of an insurance policy. So, yeah. I mean, ESPN loses Serie A to CBS Sports. There's no guarantee that ESPN will get the rights to the Premier League. I'm sure they'd love it. So if you're not going to get the Premier League and you've lost Serie A, La Liga is an insurance policy to make sure that you still have a major international soccer league that's available on ESPN+. And like you said, too, it does appeal to a brand new audience of Hispanic subscribers that up to this point, really, ESPN Plus hasn't had a lot of interest content on there that's been really appealing to that soccer audience. They don't have Liga MX games. You mean they don't have many of the Mexican games, but now they have every single La Liga game. So that brings in a whole new audience, I'm sure, that ESPN's hoping. They've spent a lot of money on those rights, so that's part of their plan too. So some good insight there by Bob. TV ratings, we don't have the CBS number on this one, but the USA-Mexico CONCACAF Nations League final on Spanish language television. What a great game that was. That was probably one of the best games I've seen in a long time. Just a kind of a theater. It was just so dramatic. But more than 4 million viewers watched this one on Univision and TUDN. And we don't know what the CBS number was, because that was on CBS Sports Network and also on Paramount Plus, and they do not reveal those numbers. But if I had a guess, I'd say maybe 2 million viewers, maybe 1.5 million, maybe perhaps. We won't know, but you mean so. But anyway, on the Spanish language side, 4 million viewers.
Yeah, they have that number internally at CBS, though, just for people who
they know. Think
maybe they have no idea. They're not Nielsen public. They're not publicly Nielsen rated, but they do have they do monitor the numbers they're getting.
They get it
internally.
And they know the Paramount Plus numbers, and they know.
Right.
And they're buying soccer rights like crazy. So these things must be pointing in a positive direction. Listener mailbag. First up is Milan Jar. Milan says, why do American presenters and announcers refuse to call it kickoff? They always refer to it as first kick or kick. I've noticed this from ESPN presenters for this tournament. What's up with that? Kartik, I've got a theory on this one.
I don't, but he's right. That is right. They always say first kick or kick.
Yeah, I think it's a she, but I think Milan. The reason that my theory is just they want to mix it up. They don't want to sound like kind of boring. Ah, here's the kickoff. But whether it's John Strong, you mean with his motto or slogan or tagline, whatever it is, they're just trying to be cutesy, funny, and just trying to, rather than say here's the kickoff, they're using their own words just to kind of make it interesting. Good point. Donald Dickinson says, great pod last week as usual. I do wonder if your take on being burnt out with all the matches, especially post-COVID, with the condensed schedule, could be the reason why Major League Soccer is not considered great amongst most of us here. After a Saturday morning or early afternoon of Man City, Liverpool, Bayern Munich, PSG, Juventus and Barcelona, plus others we watch, I wonder if that takes the air out of a Seattle or LAFC or Philadelphia Union or NYCFC MLS game late afternoon or late night if it's a West Coast start. There is nothing MLS can do, but I do wonder if people pay attention more in the morning because we are hyped up on coffee. By 6 p.m., everything is done and dinner has set. So all you want to do is chill with the family, thus you miss any great things that have happened in Major League Soccer. Kartik, I think this has been true for more than a decade, right?
Yeah, I think that also an issue with MLS for me is that I can't keep track of where the players are, and there's always new teams popping up. So there's this lack of continuity. Now I know we have promotion and relegation in Europe, so we technically have new teams, but you don't have players constantly changing teams. Now actually a league that's worse than MLS for that is Mexico, but that's part of it. So I think there's also like the stability continuity thing in terms of people not you don't know who plays for what team, but maybe it is burnout also. At the same time, you could say a lot of people do a lot of things during the day, Saturday and Sunday, with their kids, and they might be better off settling in for a game late at night or in the evening. So in that respect, MLS has an advantage.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to impact Liga MX negatively, though. I mean, so I think what it is you have the audience that's watching Major League Soccer games is almost a subset of the English language audience. The vast majority of the English language audience is watching, I mean, Serie A, La Liga, Bundesliga, Premier League, and in many other leagues. So that subset of that audience is pretty small, relatively speaking. Now, there's a whole different audience for Liga MX and Mexican Americans watching those games and making that appointment viewing times to watch those games. And at the end of the day, I always say this, but if a game's good, no matter what, people will figure out a way to watch that game. So if it's a CONCACAF Nations League game and it's on Sunday night and it kicks off between Mexico and the United States at, I don't know, 9 o'clock, 9:30, people will do whatever it takes to watch that game because they want to watch that game. If they're not watching that game, then there's a reason for that, and it might be that they're burned out, or might be that they don't give those MLS games as much priority as a game that is a Barcelona against a Villarreal game earlier in the afternoon, or whatever it may be. Disco George says, I was at the US men's national team friendly this past week, and it reminded me of just how much we miss on television. Some of the passes and through balls that Yunus Musa made in the first half were amazing. His ability, this must have been the Costa Rica game, his ability to see the spaces developing and put the ball through quickly is really cool to see in person. I was also really impressed with Brendan Aaronson and Tyler Adams and the work they put in off the ball, much of which we don't see on camera. Overall, I get a much better sense for how Greg Berhalter wants the team to play and how their press works. I'm curious to see how the Gold Cup group does with it, if it ends up being mostly MLS players. I don't know who's going to fill some of those roles. So that will be interesting to see in terms of the depth of the squad. Jacinho says, something that just came to mind vis-a-vis the national team rights for the US and Mexico. If the national team rights expire after 2022 and North America hosts the following World Cup in 26, what would be the point of trying to get the home matches if the US, Mexico and Canada will play a boatload of friendlies outside the Nations League and the Gold Cup between now and the 26 World Cup? With that said, CBS is already in a decent position regarding the CONCACAF national team competitions. I think for CBS to build upon its potential with MLS, they would be best suited for the Fox portion of MLS rights, the CONCACAF Champions League and the League's Cup. Good point there by Jairzinho, but the thing we have to remember too is that even though the United States, Mexico and Canada are not going to have qualification games leading into the 2026 World Cup, there will be a lot of friendlies, and some of those friendlies are going to be high-profile friendlies. You could have, for example, some games. So this rights package for the U.S. men's national team is one example. Leading up to the 2026 World Cup that's going to be up for bid soon, it could have a tournament in there, maybe the summer of 2025. There could be Brazil, Italy, Portugal, England, and the United States in a competition, a high-level competition, and they could give it a name. I mean, basically kind of a Confederations Cup, but based in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. So there's still some value there for sure. And yeah, at the same time, you've got the U.S. women's national team rights. They're worth just as much.
Yeah, so in Asia this time, because Qatar was concerned about not being sharp coming into a tournament, which they obviously they've never qualified for the World Cup before. Now they actually have a good team. They might have qualified anyway. But they're playing in Asian qualifiers, even though they're in the World Cup, right? So they're playing as kind of an ineligible team. I mean, we've seen this. I guess I've seen this in college sports before when teams have been on probation but have played the season. So they're playing in qualifiers. So it's possible. Now, that's one nation versus three. I don't know if CONCACAF wants to put three nations in and then assign six other spots. That complicates it more. But there is a possibility these countries could play in qualifying. We actually don't know, Chris, yet if they're all going to automatically qualify either. We're making an assumption.
They have to be, though, right?
This is a new format World Cup, and we don't know that.
Yeah, they have to be, though. I mean, I'm sure...
they have to be. I think they have to
Gianni Infantino.
But look, I mean, I thought it was... I at one point, Dublin was going to host matches in this Euro. And I for those who don't know, I support the Republic of Ireland as a European team. My second team in Europe is probably Northern Ireland. So Slovakia ended up beating both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland in the playoffs. In the playoff final, they beat Northern Ireland. They beat Republic of Ireland on penalties in the semifinal of the Euro 2020, or I guess it was, Euro 2020 playoffs. So I was thinking, you know, it would have been really weird to have games in Dublin when Ireland, nor Northern Ireland, who would have a natural affinity support in the Republic of Ireland, didn't qualify. But they were still going to host games and withdrew because of COVID. So, you know, you don't necessarily automatically qualify, although this is an odd tournament, right? This Euro where they're hosting it all over the place. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Azerbaijan wasn't even close to qualifying, and Baku's hosting matches. But yeah, I thought about that because of the Ireland situation and the fact that both Ireland and Northern Ireland were in the same playoff pod. So I thought, okay, one of them will qualify. And as it turns out, Slovakia came through there and actually this recording doing well in the tournament. So no guarantee, particularly, I think because the U.S. is hosting the bulk of games, it would not make sense for them to have to qualify. But there's no guarantee that Mexico and Canada are going to be in automatically. I think they probably will be. Well, but there's no guarantee.
Yeah. And I think there will be just because of the cozy relationship between Gianni Infantino, FIFA president, and CONCACAF and U.S. soccer and MLS, that they helped him win the FIFA presidency. So they owe... Gianni owes CONCACAF and especially the U.S. soccer. So I think they'll do whatever they can to make that happen, where it's automatic qualification. Mercator says, glad to hear I'm not the only one loving the CBS presentation of the U.S. men's national team. I get it's not everyone's taste, but CBS has a home run here. Remember, the most popular sports pre-post game in the U.S. is NBA on TNT, with a few former stars just cracking jokes while the host tries to bring it back to basketball. This crew will be a hit with casual sports fans. I was at a party and managed to get everyone to leave the U.S. men's Mexico game on television almost entirely because everyone loved Charlie Davis doing the stanky leg when bringing out the trophy. Again, not everyone's taste, but this will be popular and will grow the game. I don't mind the lack of a whiteboard. These guys are ex-players. I want to hear their honest opinions, not a detailed tactical breakdown. I really enjoyed the exchange between Dempsey and Davis on Sargent as a striker. Kartik, enjoy the over-analysis of England for the moment. They are like the Cowboys, big team that never goes anywhere. The more they hype it up, the funnier it is when things go sideways. England underperform, Germany overperform, death and taxes. Bram Weiser says, Chris, as much as you and Kartik have blasted broadcasters like NBC based on how they present their studio programs, perhaps not being sufficiently analytical, I'm very surprised to see you rave about what transpired on CBS Sports Network with the CONCACAF Nations League. There was far too much bro talk among Oguchi Onuehu, Clint Dempsey, and Charlie Davis. And sure, Oguchi and Clint gave some analysis, but they should have probably cut the side chatter at least by half, if not more, and stuck to breaking down the weekend's games for the benefit of their audience, who don't really care as much about such topics that they actually did take time to talk about, like a recent fishing trip they took. USA Mexico, as was mentioned during the weekend, the preeminent men's soccer rivalry in this part of the world, and by giving in to all that unnecessary side talk, CBS missed out on a terrific opportunity that fell into their lap by signing on to broadcast these finals, or was part of the anticipated and hoped-for benefit of doing so. I wonder how many people interested in the matches tuned out from these distractions and switched to Univision's networks to watch matches instead. If I wasn't actually watching the games on my DVR instead of live, I might have done likewise. So we know that 4 million people watched that game on Univision and TUDN. I would imagine, pretty safe bet, that the majority of those viewers were fans supporting Mexico. And I'm sure there's many supporting the United States too, but the vast majority would have been Mexican fans. But Bram Weiser, going back to what you mentioned in terms of kind of not understanding why I would think that CBS did a good job with that type of analysis, if you can call it analysis, but the pregame and halftime and postgame. To be honest, I'm not the audience for those games. That's going to, like you said, it's going to a mainstream sports fan audience. And I'm not that, but I can see what they're doing, and I think they did a good job at that. But again, it's probably not for me. Kartik, what about you? Are you that audience or not?
No, I'm not that audience. I I praised them, but I did tune out for a lot of it. I'm not denying that, and it's not. And I'm just telling you how much I love watching ESPN FC and watching Taylor Twellman at the board talk about Calvin Phillips and all this stuff. That's certainly not what we got from the CBS broadcast. But I'm not the target audience either. I think the thing about NBC though, this is important to note. Maybe it's not a byproduct of NBC, but it very well could be. So the first year, the first couple of years NBC had the Premier League, they were doing such fantastic stuff and such new stuff for an American audience that the viewership grew. Now the viewership has plateaued. I mean, with the exception of a brief spike right after the restart, Project Restart with COVID, and really it didn't even last all the way till the end of the season. It was the first few weeks after the restart. They've not seen really a bump in viewership in several seasons. So I think whatever they're doing, you know, we can criticize it from our own personal preferences. And maybe much of my criticism and criticism comes down to our personal preferences. They're clearly not getting the uptick in numbers and the growth in viewership that we're seeing for other soccer properties or for the sport in general in this country. So there's something very stale and static about NBC's coverage, which – who knows? Maybe they'll fix this coming season, especially since, as far as we know, they want to retain the rights for the Premier League.
Yeah, but it's also a kind of a dead turkey? Well, I don't know what the phrase is, but it's a final season.
Dead rubber?
Dead rubber, thank you. Well, it's not really a dead rubber, but it's a final season of their current deal. So either they go into this final season knowing that they don't have the rights for the next 3 to 6 years, or they go into that final season going like, hey, we just renewed the rights for another 3 to 6 years and we are ecstatic and we're so excited to keep on bringing you the Premier League for another 6 years. So it's interesting timing in terms of the same thing happened with Turner. We knew that Turner had lost the rights to the Champions League in their second season of their 3-year deal. So that final season was kind of, it seemed really strange because we were like, okay, we can watch these games on Turner, but we know that, you mean, they're not as invested because they're not going to have it for after year 3. Little did we know at the time that they ended it after year 2. They said, okay, we'll give it back. We're not interested anymore. Mike says, I'm curious as to what your favorite soccer-related podcasts are, both as a regular show and as a limited series. For me, besides your show, of course, I enjoy These Football Times podcast. As for a limited series, I thought American Fiasco was excellent. So, Mike, I used to listen to a lot of podcasts and not as much anymore. Probably because I'm working from my home office, so I'm not traveling back and forth to work to an office. And that was oftentimes where I would listen to podcasts in my commute. So for me, my favorite podcast, the one I listen to other than World Soccer Talk, is something called The Football Attic, which is a podcast focused on retro soccer. So it talks about soccer from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And right now is doing a series about taking old Match of the Day from the BBC episodes and analyzing them minute by minute, which I know is not for everyone. For me, I enjoy it because they talk about, you mean, some of the interesting quirks and, you mean, the production and some of the games and the games themselves and kind of how things have changed. But I think it's an interesting kind of experiment. So that I enjoy. What about you, Kartik? I know you listen to a ton of stuff out there.
Yeah, so I, like Chris, listen to not that many soccer podcasts. Most of the podcasts I listen to are history related or political related. Many of them are Guardian podcasts, so we can continue with that, which is the Guardian Football Weekly. I was a religious listener about 15 years ago through 2010, 2011, dropped off. They replaced James Richardson with Max Rushton a few years ago. Max Rushton, who I liked from Talk Sports, so I'm now back hooked on that podcast, listen to their podcast. Now I'm listening to it. This is why, Chris, your initial question, which we opened the podcast with, and I said I'm not burnt out yet. I think I probably will at some point because I'm trying to watch ESPN FC and listen to the Guardian Europe podcast every night. And so probably at some point I may drop off of Copa America because I'm trying to consume all this additional Euro content. So Guardian Football Weekly I like. As far as historic shows, I really like Quickly Kevin, the 90s show. Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? That 90s football show, I listen to that fairly regularly. It's sporadically out, but that's a show I like. And I also – These Football Times is a show I listen to – I used to listen to more regularly, but still listen to occasionally.
All right. And then the last comment we have this week on the podcast is from Mark. And Mark says, I was kind of shocked at your comments about Julie Stewart-Binks on Fubo's South American qualifiers coverage. After hearing how awful you thought she was, I went back and watched some of her halftime discussion with Melissa Ortiz. Seemed fine to me. They discussed the game, showed the highlights. Stewart-Binks directed the discussion with questions to Ortiz. I know we think ESPN is the gold standard for coverage, but come on, Chris. Have you watched Alejandro Moreno lately? I'm sure someone enjoys his yelling a new catchphrase every chance he gets, but obviously someone at ESPN think he's worth what they are paying him, which is why your criticism of Stewart-Binks was so disappointing. She's on Fubo TV. She doesn't have the production resources of ESPN or CBS Sports. Fubo must like her. They had her host a preview show for the South American qualifiers with the Cooligans. I'm not a fan of the Cooligans, but it was okay even with the Cooligans. So Mark, what I would say with that too is that my opinions I expressed in that podcast were from the very first night of the coverage that they did. And then I think we recorded that podcast that night or the next morning after. From day two of the coverage that they did, which would have been the Brazil-Ecuador game, I think it was, and then day three, which was the Tuesday games, she was much better. Still not perfect. I still definitely don't think she's the best person for that role. I think Melissa Ortiz, again, was the star of the show, very natural in front of the television, and Julie was definitely much better on day two and day three. But the studio, which is, I guess they're using the studio in Miami, which I think MediaPro, it's their studio, and I don't know, it looks just really amateurish. And that's probably part of the critique I had on Julie is that it's not just Julie herself, but the whole production was, I expect more from Fubo. Just as I expect more from ESPN, I expect more from Fubo. Fubo's been broadcasting soccer now indirectly, ESPN and CBS and beIN Sports and all those channels since 2013. So that's 8 years of knowing that soccer audience and knowing what they like and having the Fubo Sports Network and broadcasting some soccer coverage and chat shows and things like that. I just thought that I was much more impressed on day two and day three. Day one, I was not impressed, which was just my honest feedback on what I saw. All right, listeners, if you have any questions, feedback, rants or raves, want to agree with us, disagree with us, any questions about streaming, especially Euro 2020, Copa America, Gold Cup, Olympics, oh my gosh, it's going to be a crazy summer. Definitely one to kind of keep your pace, try not to get burned out, but we want you to have your say. You can always reach us via email through web at worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter at worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. Kartik, Friday, England against Scotland, 3 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. and Prende TV. I am going to be watching that game. Might even go to a pub, which is the first time I've gone to a pub to watch a game probably in, I don't know, 2 years, 14 months. It's been a long time. But what about you?
I'm not going to a pub because I'm rooting for Scotland. So,
so what about you? What are you looking forward to watching this weekend, and what are you going to do?
I'm looking forward to obviously Germany-Portugal on Saturday. That's now a must-win for Germany, and then obviously England-Scotland, every Euro match, right? Italy-Switzerland, which is on Wednesday, I think is maybe because I watched so much Bundesliga, I overrate Switzerland. I was very disappointed by their performance against Wales, although I like Wales, so I actually wanted Wales to win. A lot of good football ahead, and I'm going to enjoy my football, as I'm sure the rest of the listeners will as well.